Hey, this is Gina Grad.
Hi, this is Teresa Strasser.
Hi, everyone. This is Mike Errico.
Hey there. This is Casey Cavalier.
I'm Rocky Rose.
And you are listening to The Jay Franzi Show.
Lucky you.
Welcome to The Jay Franzi Show, a behind-the-curtain look at the entertainment industry with insights you can't pay for and stories you've never heard. Now, here's your host, Jay Franzi.
Well, hello and welcome to the show. I am Jay Franzi, and this is your backstage pass to the entertainment industry. This week, we get to talk with a musician and a studio owner. We get to talk with Jason Hale. We'll talk to him about his time on the road with Ronnie Bowman, what it's like working with Doug Stone, and we'll discuss the difference between the music scene in Kentucky and Nashville. Now, Jason is not only a great musician, but he is a great friend, and I can't wait to talk with him tonight. So if you would like to join in, comment, or fire off any questions, please head over to jayfranzi.com. Now, let's get started. Jason, sir, how are you?
Good, Jay. Thanks for having me, man. I'm thrilled to be here.
It is my pleasure. I cannot wait to get into this.
Okay.
So why don't we just jump in? So tell me what it was like being on the road with Ronnie Bowman.
Okay, well, playing with Ronnie was literally a dream come true. I grew up listening to that guy. He fronted a band that I just listened to during my youth, and called the Lonesome River Band, and he wrote a lot of their material, played bass in that group. But after that, he did a solo thing. I got a chance to work for him. Literally a dream come true, man, because I love the guy's songwriting. I love his singing. And he's just a wonderful human too. He's been a good friend over the years. After I worked for him, even, we've kept in touch.
How'd you make the connection in the first place?
That goes back to about 1998. I was in a bluegrass band called Unlimited Tradition, and we recorded a record at a label in Virginia called Doobie Shea Records that was owned by Tim Austin. And Tim was the founder of the Lonesome River Band that Ronnie sang in. And so we cut this album at his place, and Ronnie lived kind of in the neighborhood, and he would just drop by every now and then. I got to know him that way, plus just being in the bluegrass circuit with bands. He was in the Lonesome River Band at that time. I was in different groups. But where I got to know him the best was during that recording of that Unlimited Tradition record.
What do you remember most from it?
Looking through the glass and seeing people like Tim Austin and Ronnie Bowman and Dan Tominski, because Dan was a co-producer on that project. And everybody knows Dan Tominski from the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? He was the voice of George Clooney. Yeah, that was the most memorable thing, just looking through the glass at 18 years old and seeing those guys on the other side of it.
That's going to be pretty cool to have something like that happen to you at that age. What kind of studio was it?
Gosh, well, at that time it was ADATS.
How many tracks?
You know, I couldn't tell you, man. It was a large studio, though. He put out some of the best bluegrass records that came out in the 90s and early 2000s there. Ernie Thacker was some of the good stuff he put out, Ronnie Bowman, and he recorded everybody.
What was the production process like?
Well, we would have our material well rehearsed before we ever got to the studio, obviously, and we would cut everything live together. Of course, we might overdub a fiddle maybe, because we didn't have a fiddle in the band. Aubrey Haney came in and laid some fiddle tracks. But everything went down live together as far as that. And then, you know, I'll tell you kind of a interesting but sad story about that record. It was recorded twice and finished, mastered and everything. What happened was they recorded that album and they all went to lunch one day, I think, and came back to the studio, and the fire department was there, and the studio was in ashes.
Holy cow.
And a bunch of people that recorded there, a band called Five for the Gospel, and some other people from the Unlimited Tradition Band, and other people too that I'm just not mentioning and forgetting. But there was a lot of people that recorded at that studio before it burned, and they just pitched in and helped build a new studio. So after the new studio got up and running, we had to record it again.
When you got that news, how'd that make you feel?
Well, actually, to tell you the truth, man, there was a bass player in the band before me. I joined the band between the recordings of the two albums. They changed banjo players and bass players after the studio burned down, and then before they built the new one, they hired me and another banjo player named Johnny Lewis that's now with a group called Wildfire that's doing really good.
So let's go back to the recording, the one that you participated in. So what was the producer's involvement in that recording? What type of producer was he?
Well, Tim Austin produced all that stuff and engineered it. Tim was a master. I mean, both as a producer and an engineer. He taught me a lot about pocket and groove, a whole lot. Funny enough, this past year, Tim and I got to work together again for the first time since the late 90s, because I was out with Doug Stone as a bass player and he was out with Doug as his front house engineer. So after years of not seeing each other, we got a chance to work together all last year, and it was awesome. But as far as what kind of producer he was, I just picture him in my mind like a little bulldog. He knows exactly what he wants. He knows how to get it, and he will get it. And he's usually right most of the time, man. He's taught me a lot. Like I said, about pocket and groove. If anybody's interested in bluegrass rhythm guitar, check Tim Austin out. He laid down some amazing stuff there with the Lonesome River Band back in the day.
So if he's teaching you about pocket and groove, did you guys play to a click?
We did.
Were you used to it at that point?
Well, I had been in a few studio situations by that point, and I had had to play to a click before, you know. So it really wasn't a new experience. I hadn't done a lot of it, but it was something I was kind of used to. And we toured a lot, that band did, you know. We played all the time, and we would go out for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. So we were tied as a unit when we got to Tim's, and he would come to our shows and critique us and things that was going to help us in the studio. Dynamics, you know, he talked a lot about dynamics. Yeah, he was just exceptional.
That's awesome. So this is where you make the initial contact with Ronnie. What's the next step in that process?
Well, after Unlimited Tradition was over, I played in a few other bluegrass bands before I ended up working for Ronnie. Some of those were James King, David Peterson in 1946, Melvin Goins. I may be leaving some out. But anyway, Ronnie had left the Lonesome River Band and started his own thing. And I knew that he had. I just called him up one day out of the blue and told him, because I kind of had a relationship with him, you know. So I called him and I said, hey, man, if you're doing your own thing now, if you need a bass player, I'd definitely be interested. And he said, well, we've got a guy in place right now and he's doing the gig, but if something happens, I'll call. And you know how many times you hear that.
Right.
Yeah, so I didn't put a whole lot of hope in that, but I knew Ronnie was a man of his word, and I knew if something come open, he would call. Well, in June of 2005, he called, and he said, hey, the spot's open if you want it. And this was probably a year or two later, you know, from the time I called him. So we started right in, man. We had Wyatt Rice playing guitar with us, and he was the great Tony Rice's brother, and Wyatt is a world-renowned lead guitar and rhythm guitar player and recording engineer. And Craig Market was in that band, who's a unbelievably good songwriter. That was a talented bunch. I don't know what I was doing to being a part of it.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, you looked up to him all that time, and then you enter the room to first start playing with him. What's that feel like for you?
Well, intimidating. You know, I'm trying to think how old I was when I went to work for him. That was 2005, so sometime in my late 20s, but Yeah, it was intimidating, but both, like I was telling you earlier, when we first got started, literally a dream come true. But intimidating would be one word.
How nervous were you?
Well, okay, I'll give you a good example. We were playing a gig somewhere, and I had like one line of background vocals to sing in the song, and it came time for me to do it, and I just locked up, man. And I just locked up and looked at him, and he said, "Say something, anything, just say something.
Let us know you're alive."
Yeah, so, yeah, that's yeah, probably the most embarrassing thing that ever happened on that gig, but he was gracious.
He make you feel okay about it?
Oh, he never said a word about it, man, just like it never happened. Ronnie's just a gracious person.
That's awesome.
But, you know, he's had a lot of success as a songwriter since I played for him. He wrote a Brooks and Dunn song called "It's Getting Better All the Time." And he wrote a Kenny Chesney song called "I Never Wanted Nothing More." And he was a co-writer on Chris Stapleton's "Nobody to Blame But Me." So, yeah, he's still down there doing it, man, every day.
How long did it take you to feel comfortable?
Probably after four or five shows. I remember one show in North Carolina where we had Rob McCurry of the McCurry family playing banjo with us. And I remember, for some reason, just distinctly feeling after that show that I felt like I was starting to gel. And it was starting to come together for me, and I could kind of relax, you know, and enjoy being there. But yeah, the first few shows, I was young and kind of freaked out to be standing there playing bass behind one of my heroes and playing bass on a lot of the songs that he recorded the bass part to when he was standing there playing guitar, and I was playing his parts.
Right. So he knows them well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How many rehearsals did you have before you hit the road?
None. Now, I take that back. Occasionally, if we had a gig, like Ronnie wouldn't tour constantly, you know, because he stayed so busy writing songs in town. He didn't tour constantly, but like we would go maybe a little while without seeing each other or playing together. But maybe the night before a gig, we would get together and knock off the rust, you know. So I remember my first show in Columbus, Ohio, we had no rehearsal. He just sent me a set list and a CD of the material and just get up and go. It was up at the Musicians Against Childhood Cancer Bluegrass Festival there in Columbus, outside Columbus.
Now, because you were a fan and looked up to him in the first place, did you know a lot of the songs or did you have to learn them all?
I pretty much knew him. Because I had all of his solo records, and plus he was doing a little bit of maybe one or two LRB tunes in his set. I can't remember exactly.
Right. What kind of travel did you have? Was it by bus?
It was by bus. Sometimes we would fly if it was pretty good ways off. The furthest we went on that gig was we went to France, but usually when we were in the States, we were on a bus.
All right. Now there's a couple of things there I want to touch on.
Okay.
First, life on the bus. So you're young, you're new to this, you get on the bus with all these other people who are already fitting in with the team and already family. How long did it take you to become comfortable enough around them?
Well, Ronnie's wife, Garnet, man, made sure that I felt at home right off the bat. She brought meals out on every trip and fed us all and made sure that we were good. And she just took care of me like I was one of her own, you know. So the acclimation into feeling comfortable on a personal level was actually quicker than feeling comfortable on a musical level with them, to tell you the truth.
Well, that's pretty cool. So in that case, what was the life on the bus like?
A lot of hearing Ronnie and Craig bounce original songs back and forth, and they're two of the best songwriters in the business. So if you can imagine, this is like, if you were comparing it to country music, this would be like listening to Merle Haggard and Willie Nelson go down the road writing songs.
Right.
But they were doing a lot of that, you know, and bouncing songs up back and forth and just having a good time and visiting with each other and talking about life and eating good. just having a good time. Ronnie just made everything really relaxed, and yeah, it was just laid back on the bus, really. It was laid back.
Was there any joking going on?
Not really. Not with that band, but I do remember one joke with another guy that I worked for.
Well, go ahead and tell me now that you mentioned it.
Well, I went to work for a guy named Daryl Singletary.
Yeah.
And I was a big Daryl fan, again, like Ronnie, before I went to work for Daryl. I was a huge fan of his. But one day, this was when I first got in the band. I hadn't been in the band. This is probably our second or third trip out. We were somewhere, and Daryl asked the bus driver to pull into the next Dairy Queen. So we just thought he was getting lunch. So he went in there, and what he was doing was he was buying a little kid's ice cream birthday cake for one of the band members whose birthday it was not.
All right.
The steel guitar player that he was buying this birthday cake for was named Danny Mohammed. And Danny is legendary around Nashville. He played steel guitar for Ray Price for like 11 years, and he's a masterful steel guitar player and guitar player.
More importantly, what flavor was the ice cream?
Oh, now that I couldn't tell you. I remember it was pink, though.
All right. And so at that point, did you feel like your skill level met the needs of the band more so than you did going out with Ronnie?
Yeah. And again, with Daryl, you know, we had absolutely no rehearsal. It was one of those situations where they send you the material and you just woodshed at home and be ready to go, you know.
What was the difference between the life on the road with Ronnie and then with Daryl?
Well, Daryl's bus had some old country music veterans in it, you know. One of the guys worked for Tammy Wynette and Reba McEntire, and one of the guys worked for Ray Price. And the Ronnie bus was a lot of bluegrass musicians. That Ronnie was very heavily involved in country music through his songwriting, but Daryl's bus was telling old war stories about the Opry. I would hear different things like that sometimes. I can't remember them all now, but just hearing the different stories about different people, you know, the legendary stories that gets around. We've talked about one or two of those.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're on the road, you're swapping your war stories. Now you've done it a couple times. You've mentioned Nashville in Kentucky. Can you discuss kind of like the musical differences between the two areas that are so close together?
Well, that's a hard one, man. I'll tell you what I've noticed about this area in Kentucky and Eastern Kentucky, where I'm currently at, is, you know how several years ago, Texas had the Red Dirt movement with Pat Green and different Texas artists like that.
Oh, yeah.
I'm noticing a big boom in what I would just call Appalachian music. It's kind of a hybrid between folk and Americana and bluegrass and country all, you know, and maybe some of a little rock and roll, too. But I'm seeing a lot of that and a lot of original music being played here. Usually when I get calls, fortunately, I love this, but when I get calls for a lot of artists locally, it's a lot of times for songwriters, so that means I get to learn a lot of original material. In Nashville, the only time you really get to play originals is if you're cutting them in the studio, you know. If you're playing down on Broadway or something, you're playing covers for the most part. But I find that the singer-songwriter thing is really a big thing here right now, which has trickled down into all the side musicians like myself and gave us a little bit more work, which I'm very thankful for. I'm really fortunate to get to work with some good songwriters.
So when you're working with these songwriters, do you have any creative input when it comes to their songs?
Well, if I'm recording them, yes. But if it's something that's previously recorded, most people want it to sound exactly like the record. But now, over here at the studio, you know, I have a little creative input sometimes if they want it. But if they don't, that's fine too. I can just sit here and engineer, you know. But A lot of people ask me to play bass on their stuff when they come here to record. Most of the time when somebody comes here, they need somebody to do the chart process and write out all the charts for the band. And that's usually winds up being me for some reason.
Are you using the number system there as well?
Yes. The Nashville number system, man, I live by it.
So the Nashville number system's made its way to Kentucky. So that's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah.
So do you have any other embarrassing moments from the road?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was out in Branson, Missouri one time, and we was on our way to play at Silver Dollar City. I can't remember what band this was with. And we got caught in the heaviest traffic ever. There was no way we were going to make it on time. So we got out of the vehicle and started walking towards Silver Dollar City, thinking that we could get there quicker by walking than by waiting in traffic. So this guy comes along riding down the shoulder in a pickup truck, bypassing all the traffic. And he says, "Hey, you guys get in. I'll take you up here to where you need to go, you know." We didn't know who this guy was or anything. So we hopped in the back of his truck.
Yeah, of course.
When you're 20-some years old, you don't think of that sort of thing. But anyway, we got up there to the drop-off point, and I had my bass in a gig bag. And when I jumped out of the bed of that pickup truck and my feet hit the ground, the shoulder strap broke on that gig bag and my bass hit the blacktop, man. It didn't hurt it, but that was an embarrassing moment. You know, I was right there in the middle of a traffic jam, scraping my bass off the blacktop.
Dude, that's got to make your heart drop.
Oh, yeah. And when you're out on the road, sometimes I had the luxury of carrying two. Like all last year, I carried two basses, but a lot of times you're just out there with one bass, and if something happens to that, you know, what are you going to do?
You were talking about playing in France. What's different about playing in France than the U.S.?
Well, okay, man. I found that crowds over there, and maybe even Canadian crowds too, I've noticed this, they might appreciate music a little more than some American audiences, and I don't want to offend anybody by saying that, but man, people just still love live music. They attend concerts in the tens of thousands. That's what I noticed most, was just how appreciative the people were. I don't know if bands aren't as common touring as they are here in the States, but that's what I noticed. People was much more appreciative of the music.
What kind of challenges did you have playing in a different country?
Well, mainly, to tell you the truth, my biggest hang up on that trip was the food.
Why is that?
I couldn't get over the food, man. Everything was served at room temperature.
Ugh, no,
they didn't use ice. All your drinks was served at room temperature. But as far as when you have your ham and eggs in the morning, it was literally like a room temperature cold cut of ham with a few hard boiled eggs and a lukewarm drink. And at the end of that trip, the last night we were there, man, we found a McDonald's. And we, of course, went in there and bought the menu out and gorged ourselves, you know, on McDonald's the last night we were there, because we'd been eating stuff we weren't used to for 2 weeks. But that was the biggest challenge. Yeah, that was the biggest challenge on that trip. Really, I do remember all the concert productions and stuff being really top notch over there. So all that was good. I remember that. And
what about technical challenges like electricity?
Well, I didn't have to take an amp. They provided me an amp. And if I'd had to take my own amp, I couldn't have used it because of the plug-in. But whoever booked us on that gig over there supplied me with an amp while we were there, so it wasn't an issue. So I didn't really have any technical challenges on that trip. My biggest technical challenge a lot of times is just sometimes still getting used to in-ear monitors, you know?
What's the challenge for that? It seems like that would be easy.
Well, I've not found one yet that I'm happy with the sound of my bass through. It's just hard to beat an amp behind you, you know?
Well, yeah, you can't feel the air pushing from a earbud.
Yeah. You know, I've heard Nathan East has a set of, I think, 1964 Audio makes those, and they're supposed to be the best earbuds on the market for reproducing bass frequencies, but the price tag is a little hefty.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
Yeah.
It's going to be tough for a tiny little earbud to truly reproduce in the bass frequencies.
Oh, yeah. And all you're hearing of the bass is really the mids and highs. You know, you're not getting much of the lows.
So what lessons did you learn when you were out on the road?
Well, stay quiet. Keep your mouth shut. Don't talk too much. Just try to blend in. Try not to stand out, both in conversation and on stage. That's one of the biggest takeaways, maybe.
We always said in the studio that we'd rather have somebody who was a good hang versus somebody who had technical chops, because you could always teach them the technical chops.
Right.
But I can imagine that being on stage with a musician, especially a solo artist, you can't truly outshine the artist, right?
Oh, that's true, man. Yeah. You gotta find your place. And that's one reason that I concentrate big on just learning the parts on the record. I don't embellish.
What was your time with Jared Neiman like?
The money was good. And, you know, a lot of the shows we were doing, we were opening some of Keith Urban's shows up on his, I think the name of the tour was called the Set 'Em Up Tour or something like that.
That was what, 2014, right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah, I worked with Keith doing monitors back in 99. That was actually the first gig I got when I moved to Nashville.
Oh, really? Very cool.
He was amazing. He was a great artist, great guy, always nice. That was back when he was opening up for Phil Vassar.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so he was still a young guy himself.
You know, I always thought the same thing. He was extremely nice and always approachable and a very good guy, seemed like.
His wife was super nice as well. I mean, super nice.
Really?
Yeah,
I never met her.
Yeah, I've only met her in passing at the award shows and stuff, the CMAs.
Oh, okay, so, yeah.
But no, I mean, they're both super nice. But he was a very nice guy, easy to work with. He had no complaints about anything. He'd just go on stage, tell you what he wants, and he was happy.
Yeah, yeah, there you go, man.
I've worked with others that might not have been so happy, but no, he was really good.
Well, guys like that make life easy.
You're out on the road with him. What was different on that tour versus your previous two?
A lot of the, just the way we were took care of, for lack of a better word. I mean, on a gig out touring with Keith Urban and stuff, it's a little bit of a different world in a lot of ways. Say, instead of taking a bus to Utah or something like that, we would just get up that morning, fly to Utah, play the gig, and fly home first thing the next morning, you know.
But did he fly you first class?
He did not.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, possibly, man. But, yeah, just the way we were treated, I guess, just being out on that level of a tour, it was a little bit different than what I'd encountered before, maybe, a little bit.
Was catering better?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, catering was always pretty good. Yeah. With Daryl, man, a lot of times be playing in the southeast part of the U.S., so it was a lot of times just somebody's good barbecue, you know.
I was
just
gonna say, a lot of barbecue.
Yeah, yeah. But with Jared, you know, it was always pretty good meals.
What was your favorite venue to play in?
Well, probably the coolest venue I ever played was Heinz Field up in Pittsburgh, where the Steelers play.
Yeah.
We played there July the 3rd, and the reason I remember that is because they were shooting off fireworks. Yeah, it was July 3rd, 2014, and that's probably the coolest venue I ever played. I've got a picture of me walk out in the field, and I went down in the locker room and took a few pictures and stuff, and I've still got those somewhere, but I couldn't tell you where somewhere.
I've got a lot of pictures like that before social media. I had a lot of, like, photo albums somewhere in the garage or something.
Yeah. And that gig was the U.S. and Canada. We went to Canada once or twice, but it was mostly in the States. But
where in Canada did you go?
We played a country music festival in a, I'm not going to pronounce this right, but it seems like the name of the place was called Buktush. They had a country music festival there, and Prince Edward Island. We hit that when I was with Ronnie.
Did you ever play in Toronto?
No, never did.
Yeah, I've gone up to Buffalo, never got on the other side of the falls, never from the Toronto side. So we got overlooked the city, and it was a beautiful view from the Buffalo side, but I've never had the opportunity to go on the other side.
Oh, yeah.
Never went over in a barrel. You know, I didn't get any of the experience.
Well, you got to get the full effect one of these days.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So you're on the road now with Doug Stone.
Mm-hmm.
What's that like?
Well, every gig is different. The dynamic is different between the artist and the side musicians, which is what I call me, a side musician, bass player. Some people you work for, you get to know them, and you form kind of a little bit of a bond or friendship maybe after a while. But
like you did with Ronnie.
Some people you're... Yeah, and Daryl, we became good buddies during that time. But with Doug, he's a very nice guy and super easy to work for, and he sings his heart out every night. But some of them's more of an employee and employer type situation. And that's sort of, I guess, maybe how it is with Doug. It's not that he's not a nice guy or anything like that. It's just I'm not around him enough to get to know him.
Right.
The most I'm ever around him is during the hour and 15 minutes or hour and a half that we're on stage, you know, and that's the extent of when I'm around him the entire day, usually. I see very little of him.
Well, that's a good point. Is he one of the artists that flies to gigs while the band takes the bus?
Yeah. Yep. Doug lives, I'm wanting to say, Texas. Yeah, the band meets up in Nashville
right.
at the bus. And then we take the bus from there to wherever the gig is, unless it's a fly date, but most of them's bus dates. And then Doug just flies from his place of residence to wherever we're at in Oregon or North Carolina or whatever. He walks in at sound check, and we do sound check, and a couple hours later it's showtime, and after the gig's over, it's like, well, you know, great show. See you at the next
one. Have a good night.
Have a good night, man.
People, they don't think of it like this, but I mean, he lives in a different state. It's not easy to just hop on a bus with everybody else. It's not that he's doing it not to be social.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Could you imagine having to drive to Nashville to meet us right. every time we have a gig? You know what I mean?
You fly to Nashville just to drive back across the country.
Yeah, exactly.
No, and I mean, I've been on the road with artists, too. I mean, I was on the road with Steve Holy for a very short period of time, supporting Matt McClure, who was the front of house engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out to Texas. We played Billy Bob's. And
oh, cool.
Steve took a different bus. It wasn't because he didn't want to be social. It's just there was mm-hmm. so many people, and with family and everything, you don't want to be on the bus with all the band members
yeah.
that are there drinking right. and partying and stuff. Do you ever play Billy Bob's?
No, I never did, man. I've been in Texas a bunch and probably played it more in 2023 than I had my whole life. But I never have got to play Billy Bob's, but I've got to play a bunch of those Texas dance halls. I like playing them.
I had the opportunity to see you at Laurie's Roadhouse in Ohio,
mm-hmm.
and it reminded me a lot of Billy Bob's. I mean, Billy Bob's is probably a little older and a little dirtier and stuff, but it was the same type of venue, just big open venue.
Yeah.
The room was probably very hard to tame from an engineering point of view,
mm-hmm.
but it was just a fun place to be. I mean, just like Laurie's Roadhouse.
Yeah, that's a fun place to play up there. I get to play there every now and then, Laurie's. But did you ever hear any of the live albums that were recorded at Billy Bob's?
If I did, I didn't know.
Well, I tell you, a good one to check out, man, is Exile, live at Billy yeah. Bob's.
Tony Cottrell, engineer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They had a band together at that time with Ray Salyer on bass, who's a really good friend of mine, and I've looked up to him, too, as a player for years. He's been doing this a long time, and he's a pro. He's with John Michael Montgomery right now, but
not
he's playing
artist.
On that record. Yes, yeah. And, you know, that's another artist that's retiring, I think.
He's from your world in Kentucky, too.
Yeah, yeah. He lives down around Lexington or Nicholasville area somewhere.
I went to a breakfast with the governor, and it was his son or brother or somebody was playing.
Was his name Walker?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that is John's sister's son,
okay.
if I'm not mistaken. But he's a really good artist, Walker is.
Oh, yeah, no, it was great. He, like I said, it was a political event. He played like three or four songs. It was really cool.
Yeah.
You mentioned Exile. Tony Cottrell was on the show a while back, and He was a mentor of mine. I actually went to school in 1989 at a recording school in Ohio, and he was my teacher. Mm. And then later I went off to work, and I was working in New York. And when I moved to Nashville, I wanted to go teach at the engineering college. And when I went in there to talk to the director of education, it just happened to be Tony. And Tony was the director of education there. And he politely told me I didn't qualify and that I had to go become qualified if I wanted to teach.
Oh.
I told him I would, and he goes, I have no doubt. So about a year later, I came back with the qualifications necessary. I started teaching mm-hmm. there, and eventually he moved out of the position, and I took over.
Oh, cool.
He's been in touch ever since, and he is currently on the road with Exile now, I believe.
Oh, okay,
and
cool.
He's also done a lot of their studio work. Good guy. Mm-hmm. Good times.
Well, so where's he from? Originally Ohio? Or
from Ohio, Chillicothe.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay, cool.
The recording workshop, and he was the teacher there at the recording workshop. He was a drummer, but he taught mm-hmm. recording over at the workshop.
Well, that's awesome. You know, I know another guy that works as an engineer for Exile named Dwayne King. He's here in Kentucky where I'm at, or close to me, about an hour away, actually.
Well, let's talk about your studio. You open up your own studio, and you're recording mm-hmm. all sorts of artists, and you actually stay pretty busy. Can you mm-hmm. tell us what type of artist you're recording?
Yeah. A lot of what I do is singer-songwriters. I've had piano vocalists in here doing gospel. I've had acoustic guitar players that do singer-songwriter stuff. I've had some people come in and record some spoken word for narration in a documentary that was about a Hatfield and McCoy type situation that happened locally here. And country bands. And I was just talking to a guy today about coming over to record, but a lot of country groups and gospel and bluegrass and singer songwriter type things.
Well, let's set the picture a little bit. I mean, you are far out in Kentucky. It's not like you're near a major city.
Yeah, I'm in the sticks.
Yeah, it really surprises me that there's that much music out where you are. I mean,
oh, man.
Kind of describe the scene there. I mean, what's the music scene like?
Well, there's more musicians right now, probably in this area, than I've ever seen. And other than the few years I lived in Pigeon Forge and Nashville, I mean, I've been here observing it since the late 90s, and there's more here than I've ever seen, I would say. But yeah, it's a crazy time. There's plenty of musicians, and there's just a wealth of talent here, man. I mean, not counting just the people I work with, but I mean, this area is legendary for producing world-class talent. Man, I could go down a list of people that's came from within an hour of here that's just dominated the scene on a professional level.
Do you think it's all bluegrass?
Well, some of it is. There's a fair amount of bluegrass. There's a lot of bluegrass, but not as much as you would think, it being the bluegrass state. I mean, as far as I know, there's no place in Lexington you can go and hear a live bluegrass band unless you go to a specific event like a festival or something, you know. But on a regular basis, there's no place to go do that.
You say Lexington being probably the closest big city to you, which is,
yeah,
what, an hour away?
About 45 minutes, yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And Moorhead is about 15 minutes away. Another thing that's in the scene here is there's a lot of there's a few honky-tonks to play around Moorhead and Lexington area, you know, East Central Kentucky. So there's some of that that goes on, you know, in country bands. And some of those spill over into Lorries, like where I seen you a few weeks ago with Kyle.
We have to talk about Lorries for a second because
okay,
you told me, you know, come on out, we're playing at Lorries Roadhouse in Ohio.
Yeah.
I said, great, fantastic. I'm thinking, you said it's a honky-tonk or whatever, so I'm picturing this hole-in-the-wall bar. I get there, first of all, it's a strip mall, but second of all, I walked in the front door and all you see is the, you know, ticket taker. So I go up, you know, get in, and you round a corner, and as soon as you round the corner, it just opens up like the size of a football field. We're not talking about a yeah. little honky-tonk bar or anything. And all you see is posters down the wall of all the famous artists that have played there. So, I mean, What were you thinking the very first time you went in that place?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, A, I'm thankful to be here, and B, it's just another day at the office. Go in and do my job, and thankful to be there.
Was it what you expected when you went in?
No, it was a lot bigger than I expected.
Someone said it used to be a Kroger.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, someone was telling me it used to be a Kroger, which, if you don't know, is a supermarket in a strip mall. So you walk into a strip mall, you walk through the Kroger front door, and all of a sudden you're in this giant music venue. And when I say giant, I mean giant. It was not small. Not a small venue at all.
Oh, yeah. It's a big place. I don't know how many thousand square feet it is, man, but it's huge. I mean, it's so big, they've got two stages.
Yeah.
The main stage is huge, but the side stage is big, too.
Oh, yeah.
It's plenty big enough for a 5 or 6 piece band to play.
The side stage is bigger than most honky tonks' main stage.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Especially in Nashville, those honky tonks there, you're lucky if you get a, you know, 5x5 in a lot of cases.
Oh, yeah. Right up next to the window.
Right. Right in the corner next to the window. And you're lucky if that window opens.
You know, I don't know when we're playing in Laurie's again. Up there near Cincinnati, but I think we've got some gigs coming up around Columbus the first weekend of April with Kyle Fields, who's another songwriter I get to play with a lot.
Kyle's awesome.
Actually a Kentucky boy. Yeah, he is, and he's been real good to me. He's actually from Kentucky, but he lives in Nashville. So, and we're some distant relation. We're from the same area, but he lives in Nashville, and you know, he was asking about what the scene is like here a little bit. I mean, it's really, it's thick with songwriters right now. A lot of singer songwriters, and a lot of them's good too. I mean, people should check out, Kyle Fields and Sarah Beth Terry and, Clark Kissick and Reed Fields and Nathan Arnett and Jake Vanover. I mean, I've just been fortunate here lately to get to work with some good songwriters. Hope that's the case the rest of the year.
Well, with Nashville having such a boom, do you feel like there's a lot of artists or songwriters moving their way into Kentucky?
Not necessarily, but I do think that Nashville has got its ear tuned into the whole Appalachian thing, the Tyler Childers movement that's kind of started. I think Nashville knows about that, you know, and knows what's going on.
Well, I know when I was in Nashville, I was there for 20 years, and I remember when I first moved there, people asked me where I wanted to live, and I ended up south of Nashville, but somebody was asking me if I'd want to live over the border of Kentucky because they said it was much cheaper to live there.
Mm.
And at the time, I thought to myself, oh, that's too far away. I don't want to be that far away. Now I live in Kentucky, so I don't think it's that far away at all.
Oh, yeah.
But at the time, it was a consideration for a brief moment, but I decided to be right there in the heart of Nashville.
Yeah, I know several musicians that live around Franklin, Kentucky, and Bowling Green, that area, and commute to Nashville for gigs and sessions and stuff.
Yeah, I used to go to Bowling Green quite a bit just to write with people or just to work with people. So it was cool. All right, sir. Well, we do this thing here we call Unsung Heroes, where we take a moment to shine the light on somebody who's worked behind the scenes or somebody who has supported you. Do you have anybody you'd like to shine a little light on?
Yeah. There's a guy in Nashville named Roger Carter, who I think he's originally from Alabama, but he is a mad scientist of bass. This guy has studied bass, man, to the point of just minuscule dissection. I mean, I've never really taken a lesson from him, but he has helped me so much in just sending me things to listen to or scale patterns to think about or different ways to get around the neck. And he's helped me a ton over the years. And he taught me how to set up a bass guitar. He's the guy that taught me how to do that. But he's been really helpful. Just a wealth of knowledge. He worked with Bob Babbitt, the famous Motown bass player. But yeah, Roger Carter, everybody should get to know Roger down in Nashville. He is a bass guru.
A big thanks to Jason for taking the time to share his stories with us. And thank you for taking the time to hang with me here. I really do appreciate it. Please follow, share, and connect on all the socials. You could even tell a friend. I would appreciate that too. You can do all this and find the links to everything mentioned over at jfranzi.com/episode55. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Jay Franzi Show. Make sure you visit us at jfranzi.com. Follow, connect, and say hello. This episode has been brought to you by VR Knives, your source for 100% custom knives made by a true rock star. So, if you're in the market for a new piece of art, reach out to VR Knives. 407-421-5528. 407-421-5528.